Position number 21593, Rule 4.
Leslie Winspear, Rule 4.
Clearing the pot of Canadian dollars. I can't remember what I did with these, but I probably put them in an envelope and sent them back to England, where they would no doubt be put to good use. But the bomb was rather interesting, the grenade. It was about a foot long, like a German stick grenade. And it had, you pulled off the end of the stick, and exposing tapes which you pulled to arm it, and then the tapes which came out probably were meant to stabilize the direction of the bomb as it traveled through the air, because it was a wedge-shaped thing. The narrowest part was where the stick was, and then there was a sort of cup at the end, and the end of the cup was domed, and then the cone came back to join onto the stick. And when we got it back to the reserve area, I telephoned various people. They said, well, we've seen these things before. To take some photographs and send us the photographs and then blow it up. And I went along to the assault pioneers, who were the demolition experts in the battalion. And Sergeant Pepe Webster, who was the assault pioneer sergeant, the Captain Stackpool, who was the assault pioneer's officer, he later got a periodic military cross for his work on the Hook, and went to teach at Ableforth College, having taken holy orders later. But Pepe Webster, I knew in passing in those days, but later in the Hallamshires, when I had been commissioned and was a captain, and he came along quite out of the blue as a sergeant major nearly 10 years later, as my company sergeant major. And he came in, saluted, and then when I looked up from my desk, he said, "Bloody hell, it's Corporal Winspear. Sorry, Captain." However, he went off to blow the grenade, and some time, no, I was pleased to get rid of it. But he came to see me next day. He said, "Look," he said, "come down to the riverbank. He said, I want to show you the crater this grenade of yours made." And the ground was still frozen to a depth of about 2 feet. And they just laid it on the sand by the side of the river and then detonated it. But it had blown a hole about 2 meters in diameter and a meter and a half deep. And he said it would take about 4 pounds of cordite and gun cotton to make that size of hole. So I don't know what sort of explosive you had in that Russian grenade, but I suspect now that it was a forerunner of something like Semtex. But if it had gone off in the back of the truck, for example, we wouldn't be telling this tale quite so comfortably. The from Nachon, we then took up the left-hand position, or the brigade did, and the Dukes with it. And first of all, we were in the reserve position on the Hook, which was the support battalion, which occupied the a company position overlooking the Samichon, but not under threat in any way, and was merely in support of the Hook. And then in May, we moved onto the Hook itself. We moved up into the Hook position on the 12th of May, which was my birthday. And I was beginning to get a bit superstitious about birthdays by this time, because as we moved in, the monsoon broke, and the trucks were soon making ruts 2 feet deep, and the road was becoming impassable. And all the soldiers had to get out the trucks, get up the hillsides, find stones and put them in the ruts to keep the trucks moving, so that the relief in the line could take place as planned that night. And we spent all day in torrential monsoon rains trying to keep the convoy moving north of the Imjin. It was only about 10 kilometres, but it was a day's journey to get in there. And from there we went up into the hook position, and occupied the battalion headquarters situation with D Company on the hook peak, Charlie Company, my old company, on the sausage position to its right, supporting it, and another company behind on the next hill, with the assault pioneers on a small hill between the hook itself and the reserve position, as it was called, about 400 yards back. And in that position we spent about 2 weeks reinforcing the fortifications with the help of the Royal Engineers, digging making overhead cover for the communications trenches, and for the machine gun emplacements, because we had two Browning 300 machine guns from the Americans to each platoon, in addition to its normal armaments of Bren guns. And the Chinese position were only about 120 yards away on Ronson. And the sniper section and I experimented with anti-tank rocket launchers fired from our own positions into their heavy machine gun emplacements. But after a couple of goes, it wasn't successful, because the blowback fumes, which went back up to the communication trench junction and then back into the covered gallery, were almost suffocating, and you could never, the smoke and the heat generated was such that you could never be absolutely sure that you'd hit your target at the opposite side anyway, except that those weapons were so accurate that it's almost certain that they went into the embrasure and destroyed the heavy machine gun that was in there. But you could never see for sure. And we were almost suffocated with the explosion and the rocket power and so on, so we stopped doing it. At that time, it became apparent that a Chinese attack was being built up, and I was able to show from inspection of aerial photographs that they were digging tunnels on the back of the feature codenamed Warsaw, which were forming up position tunnels, each of which was capable of holding at least 100 men, and that an attack was imminent from that direction, as well as from Ronson, which was quite close. By this time, the soldiers were sitting behind their machine guns on the hook, for example, virtually 24 hours a day. They were smoking 50 cigarettes during the day and 50 cigarettes during the night, eating when they could, what they could, and just waiting for the attack. Heavy artillery howitzers were being used on the position, and the earth shock could be felt, but very seldom was anything containing any personnel hit, because only the crown of the hill was manned, and it made it a very difficult target for the enemy artillery, most of which came down into the areas behind the hill and made the medical aid post behind the hill almost untenable. And that quickly filled up with wounded from shell splinters in the main. And mortar fire was also put down on the hill. And to everyone's surprise, the Chinese attacked at about 8 o'clock in the evening, just about 20 minutes before last light, through their own barrage, taking casualties from their own artillery fire. But they were in through our wire on D Company and throwing themselves into the weapon pits, carrying satchel charges of TNT. Sometimes they threw the satchel charge in, sometimes they threw themselves in. And by about 10 o'clock, the position was overrun, but the men were still in the tunnels and underground. And the defensive fire tasks were deployed. And this meant bringing airburst fire onto the position. And eventually the counterattack went in at about 1 o'clock in the morning, led by the rugger players, Gilbert Smith from A Company and Campbell Lamson from C Company, and a pincer movement to recover the hook position, which couldn't be occupied by the Chinese because you couldn't live on the place with the airburst fire that was constantly put down. And the Dukes fought back from their tunnels. Several men lost a foot kicking out a satchel charge of TNT, which was thrown in, and at least one was decorated for that. And it was at this point that I recall asides made in the command post by the commanding officer, Colonel Ramsay Bunbury. He'd always said that his soldiers were so steady under fire there had to be a reason for it, and he thought it was two things. Firstly, that the average age of the conscript soldier, who made up 75% of the battalion, was over 21, because most of them had done an apprenticeship before being taken into national service. And secondly, many of them from Leeds and Sheffield and from the Yorkshire, the areas of Yorkshire that had been drafted into the Duke Wellingtons, had experienced the Blitz in the war, and so they knew what the noise of explosions and the earth shock it could produce was. And so the heavy artillery fire of Korea was no new experience to them. It was interesting to recall other things. For example, when we were on Nai Chon, a patrol was overrun in one of the forward positions, and the lance corporal in charge had rolled down the hillside on one side of the spur that the standing patrol had occupied. And when the Chinese came to inspect the body of one of his colleagues who'd been killed by a Chinese grenade, he threw two grenades up and in turn killed the Chinese. And I remember the colonel jumping up when he heard this and saying, "That's worth an immediate MM." And he put it in hand, and Corporal Bailey got his military medal in due course. The the duties of the intelligence team were to collect what intelligence could be obtained from wherever it could be obtained and pass it into the command post and mark it on the maps and so on, and provide general backup for the colonel's direction of the battle, and to train up the observation posts in the companies and make good use of what could be gleaned from watching the enemy at work where that was possible. But by this time the war in Korea had settled down to being a night war rather than a day war, because the accuracy of sniper fire was particularly effective, and on Naechon we were taking casualties almost every morning from Chinese sniper fire at first light, to the extent that Phil Seymour and I were once sent out into no man's land to lie up from about 4 o'clock in the morning and then spot the Chinese sniper, and by firing tracer at him, so that the Centurion tanks supporting us on the hilltops could spot it and shoot him up with their guns as long-range snipers, more effective than we could be. And when we eventually spotted him firing from a small hole about just above the bush line, where the bushes still grew below their communication trenches, which had been devastated of greenery by our artillery fire. Phil Seymour fired his three tracer rounds faster than me, and the arrangement was we'd bug out quickly and run over the paddy field buns and be covered by smoke. But Phil Seymour slapped me on the shoulder and said, "I hope for his own sake he's well dug in." And with that, the first of the tank tracer rounds went into his emplacement very accurately. And I fired my last shot and trotted after him. And when I caught him up, I said, "This smoke's taking its time." And he said, "Yes, what do you think that is?" And we could hear the thud of Chinese mortars opening up behind us. And I said, "You've got 26 seconds to get out of here before they hit the ground." And, of course, in 26 seconds we were 400 yards away, and the Chinese mortars came down on where they'd last seen us. And in two jumps like that we were round behind the hill and into a vehicle revetment before they got our range. But the smoke, for some reason, typical in the army, never arrived. Somebody must have forgotten about it. And in another, on one of the minefield spotting days, I was on a forward position again with Phil Seymour when that position was shot up by one of our own tanks in the neighbouring, from the neighbouring brigade, mistaking it for a Chinese hill. A tank had been relieved and they were firing on our living quarters on the friendly side, and everybody had to move into the weapon pits on the enemy side because it was safer there. And the communication system was such that to tell that tank to stop could only be done by going through our company to the battalion headquarters, to brigade headquarters, to divisional headquarters, to the next brigade headquarters, the battalion, and so on. Because although we were only half a mile apart, we were on different wireless frequencies, and there was no way of getting through to them quickly that they were shooting up friendly forces. Luckily, nobody was hurt. But these were typical of the mistakes that can occur in wartime. The Hook battle had another side, interesting sideline for me, in that when we spotted the Warsaw tunnels as forming up positions, the battle adjutant asked the patrol master, which was another sort of technical job, if it was worth sending somebody to look at the use of those tunnels. And the Jeff Cork, as intelligence officer, discussed this with me, and I said that I didn't think there was any point. You could tell the size of them from the amount of spoil. You could even measure them off the photographs. And you could, it was just a question of when they were going to be used, and nobody could predict that. And that I thought that it was a waste of a patrol and possibly risking people's lives going to actually look at them. However, that very afternoon, the patrol master came just round to see Jeff Cork and said, could Corporal Winspear go with him to look at the tunnels? And knowing my view, Jeff Cork said he didn't think it was worth it, and the battle adjutant or patrol master said, well, that would be a matter for the CO to decide. And to save my skin, Jeff Cork, without telling me at the time, said, your number's come up. He said, you haven't had any leave. You haven't asked for any. He said, but I've been told that you've got to go down to the leave camp at Ebisu for 3 days leave. And off I went. And when I came back just before the Battle of the Hook, the patrol master was dead. Having been carried, his body having been carried back wounded by the sapper corporal that he took with him on this patrol that what I thought at the time was not going to do anybody any good. I managed to survive that occasion, I think he wanted to avoid a confrontation because he knew that several months earlier I'd been asked to volunteer for a patrol with the rugby playing Campbell Lamberton, who wanted to go out on the Hook reserve position, and the CO got me in himself and said that I'd been asked for because I knew the ground, I knew the minefields, I was good with a compass, I could... And what did I think about it? And I said, well, You need poachers out in no man's land, people who can move silently and without being seen. Have you looked at the size of Campbell Lambton's feet, sir? Size 12. And I said, I just can't imagine him being quiet enough, and I don't see any point in going across there, because as far as we can see, there are no Chinese in immediately opposite, and it has no strategic value. And I think a patrol would be a waste of time and effort. Luckily, I must have managed to convince Colonel Bunbury, because he told Major Kavanagh of Charlie Company that he didn't think it was a good investment of time and effort. And I think Jeff Cork was afraid I would say something similar to that and put the cat among the pigeons if I did, so he sent me off to the local leave camp. There's a story goes round my village in Yorkshire about how I saved someone's life in Korea. And about 5 years ago, maybe eight, my brother, youngest brother, who was a builder, fell ill, and he wanted to recruit another mason in his little building team. And he eventually got somebody, and during the interview, he was told by this Yorkshire lad that his uncle's life had been saved in Korea by Stuart's brother Leslie. And he telephoned me and said, you know, what's all this about? And it turned out that the chap's name was Wood, and I knew some Woods in Korea. If it's the incident I'm thinking of, I may have saved his life temporarily, but not for long, because it was while we were in the reserve position in the hook, on the hook, and we had a chap in a rifle company burning some rubbish, and when the hole in the ground started, the fire started to peter out, he got a petrol can and threw some more petrol on it, and it went up and blew up the petrol can, and he was covered in petrol and he was badly burned. And he was invalided out, and by our own methods, which were an ambulance jeep, when the phone rang, and one of my friends from one of the other villages said, so-and-so from Lingdale, which is the next village, has been badly burned. Can you get a helicopter off the Americans to get him out? Because he might not make it if he's got to wait for the ambulance jeep to come up. And the Americans were about 3 kilometres away across the Imjin River plain, but on the same side. And so I immediately grabbed my rifle and started off at the trot across this 3 kilometres. When I got to their stockade sort of thing, barbed wire place, they were an artillery unit with 8-inch guns nicknamed Persuaders, long range. But they had helicopters which carried their ammunition in, and they would use them as a favour for other people. And they had a pod on the side for a stretcher. And I trotted across this place and asked for the aid centre, saw their doctor, and I said, you know, any chance of getting a... Yes, he said, well, go straight away. So within a matter of minutes, the an American helicopter was going up to B Company's position. And I didn't find out till later that this lad who was injured had used to take out my sister Marjorie and then married a girl from my village called Dinah Brown, who, another girl I'd sat beside in the village school. And when the various time lapses had taken place, I wrote to Dinah Brown and said how sorry I was and so on. But he lived for 11 days, but then died of his burns. And that's as near as I can get to the origin of the